Hello, it's Wednesday the 26th of February and welcome to another edition of Career 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. There are now over 1,200 confirmed COVID-19 cases in South Korea, with 12 related deaths. The National Assembly has passed a set of emergency bills in response to the outbreak. We'll have more details in our news briefing shortly. And then later, for our in-depth analysis, we'll talk to two experts on how the outbreak got to this point, what actions need to be taken next. And then for Korea Book Club, we'll be looking at a much-anticipated English translation of a Korean crime thriller called The Only Child by Seom Ye. We'll have all that and more on today's Korea 24. We begin with our daily news briefing. And for that, we have joining us in the studio now, Rosine Park from the KBS World News Center. Hi, Rosine.
Hello, Jang-won.
So while South Korea's efforts to tackle the coronavirus outbreak here continues, the number of COVID-19 infections has topped 1,200.
Yes, that figure there includes the 169 additional cases reported early Wednesday and the 150 new cases announced this evening. The central quarantine headquarters under the Korea Centers for Disease Control and Prevention compiled the new coronavirus cases from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. So that brings the total to 1,261. Among the latest patients, 82 were from the hotspots Daegu and North Gyeongsang province. And as you mentioned, the death toll remains at 12. On the upside, two more patients were released after making full recoveries. So that's 24 now discharged and free of the virus.
Prime Minister Chung Sae-kyun, meanwhile, reiterated the government is working to mobilize all available resources to contain the fast-spreading disease as soon as possible. But that battle here has been going on for over a month now.
Yeah, Prime Minister Jung, he's been stationed at Daegu City Hall, right in the middle of the hardest hit area, and he's been there since Tuesday. He said the government is doing its best to implement intensified quarantine measures there and focusing on curbing the spread within 4 weeks. He stressed that this week will be a crucial point in their fight against the virus and stressed the importance of cooperation, again, among central, local governments and civilians. Jung also recognized the many doctors and nurses who've been volunteering from across the country to help treat citizens in Daegu and adjacent areas. But he said that more assistance is really needed from the medical community because of the continuous rise in cases there.
The mass community spread of the novel coronavirus in that region revolves around the Shincheonji Church of Jesus. And its followers, of course, the government said, is moving quickly to contain the virus further via the secretive religious group. And the first step was to secure a complete list of its members, which they've managed to do now. Mm-hmm. What's next?
Well, the Central Disaster and Safety Countermeasures Headquarters secured that list of 212,000 Shincheonji followers, and that's being distributed to local governments, which will then start conducting virus tests. More than half of the confirmed cases in the country, as we know, link back to this act.
And Shincheonji is also drawing attention for its possible connection to a hospital near Daegu, which has emerged as another major outbreak site in the country.
Right. So the elder brother of the Shincheonji Church of Jesus leader, Iman Hee, was found to have suffered from pneumonia before dying late last month at Daenam Hospital in the North Gyeongsan provincial county of Cheongdo. According to Shincheonji's Daegu branch, Yi's elder brother was transported there in an ambulance on January 27th after having difficulty breathing. An official from the church said it can't be determined whether he developed pneumonia due to COVID-19 because there wasn't an autopsy. Now, suspicions are growing as to how the members of the religious sect began to contract the disease in the first place. A Hong Kong Daily reported that Shincheonji held meetings in Wuhan, which is the virus epicenter in China, and that was up until last December. Today, the South China Morning Post said some 200 members of the sect in Wuhan only stopped gathering after realizing that their community had been hit by the virus, and most are reportedly under quarantine outside Wuhan. A 28-year-old kindergarten teacher who is a Shincheonji member said rumors about the virus began circulating back in November, but no one took them seriously until the following month.
Now, elsewhere, more countries are enforcing entry and travel restrictions against South Korean nationals and travelers who've recently been to South Korea. Apparently, Japan is the latest now.
Yes, Japan is joining Vietnam and Singapore in banning the entry of travelers who recently visited the city of Daegu and nearby Cheongdo County. Japan said it's going to ban the entry of foreigners who've been to these areas starting from midnight, so Thursday, 12 a.m. And that decision was reportedly made during a meeting of officials led by Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
Now, Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa has been addressing the recent rise in travel restrictions against South Korea, including ones imposed by Chinese authorities in certain provinces. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, Minister Kang was speaking to reporters in Geneva on Tuesday, and she described the compulsory quarantine of arrivals from South Korea by airport authorities in Weihai City in China's Shandong province as excessive, which she has expressed similar concerns about Israel's entry ban and those being carried out by dozens of other countries. So what happened was authorities in Weihai said over 160 passengers on a flight from South Korea had to undergo 14-day mandatory quarantine. Minister Kang said the action was excessive and pointed out how South Korea has refrained from taking similar actions against China over the COVID-19 outbreak. She said it's hard to accept that countries are imposing bans on South Koreans simply because they are from South Korea and stressed that Seoul needs to continue communication with Beijing.
Now, back here in Seoul, lawmakers returned to the National Assembly today after being closed a couple of days due to a coronavirus scare. And they did some work. They passed three bills aimed at tackling the coronavirus outbreak.
Yes, they approved the bills to revise acts on infectious diseases, quarantine, and medical service. So under an amended Infectious Disease Act, people who refuse to take a test ordered by health authorities now could face a fine of up to 3 million won. The health minister can also ban exports of face masks and hand sanitizers for a specific period of time to prevent a supply shortage and price rigging. While more provisions of protective masks are going to be provided to children and seniors during epidemics. Now, epidemiological experts under the health ministry will be expanded from the current 30 to 100, and the ministry will require medical personnel to check a patient's overseas travel history when prescribing medicine. Now, the health minister will also be able to request the justice minister to ban the entry of foreigners coming from a country affected by or at risk of an infectious disease.
We'll leave it there for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates, Rosine.
Thank you.
Coming up next, in-depth news analysis. You're listening to Korea 24 from KBS World Radio.
South Korea has become the first nation outside of China to pass the unwelcome milestone of 1,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. And in fact, we're almost reaching 1,300 now. As the government continues to make all-out efforts to contain the further spread of the virus, questions continue to be asked about whether authorities could have handled things differently and what needs to happen next. To try and answer some of these questions today for our in-depth analysis, we have two guests joining us on the line. First, we have Dr. John Linton, who also goes by his Korean name, Dr. In Yo-han. Dr. Linton is the director of the International Healthcare Center at Yonsei University's Severance Hospital. And we also have Dr. Jerome Kim standing by as well. Dr. Kim is the director general of the International Vaccine Institute that is based here in Korea. Gentlemen, thank you for making the time to speak to us today.
Thank you for inviting us to your program.
My pleasure.
Dr. Linton and Dr. Kim, we spoke to you both on separate occasions in late January when the COVID-19 outbreak was just hitting Korea and before it was even called COVID-19 at the time. Since then, the situation has become much more aggravated, especially with the huge spike in infections in Daegu and the surrounding areas. Dr. Linton, let me start with you. What have you made of this situation since we last spoke? Has your hospital been affected at all?
It's always easy to talk in hindsight, but I think the failure to stop the travel from China to Korea was probably the cause of all of these sporadic outbreaks in Daegu. It would have been very good if we had had a little better, a little better border protection. However, the CDC of Korea, the Infectious Disease Society, and the Korean Medical Association all recommended this, and for reasons not just medical, I think that it was decided that the border would not be closed or the planes coming in from China would not be stopped. And I think on top of that, one other quick comment is the exchange of parishioners of this Shincheonji, this exclusive church, I think is the reason why we're seeing all the cases in Daegu.
Dr. Kim, Dr. Linton there just mentioning one of the primary reasons may have been the fact that we didn't stop travel from China entirely. Of course, we did have a partial ban on people traveling through Hubei area and Wuhan. Would you say that has been a main cause of this spike in in infections in Korea?
So I think that it's definitely the outbreak is related to the outbreak in China. And the idea that you were going to restrict travel primarily from the areas that were heaviest hit potentially created a situation where other parts of China or other territories could result in transmission. But, I think that one of the lessons of this epidemic and other epidemics is that we have to be prepared because, who knows where the Italian man contracted his infection, because we can't trace it. Mm-hmm. And the outbreak is occurring in Italy, and Italy has over 200 cases now and more deaths than Korea. So I think, in hindsight, it's easy to say on the one hand. On the other hand, there are a lot of other ways for infection like COVID-19 to get to Korea and to set up a cell of infection, a cluster of infections. And sometimes, worship practices, or you remember during the MERS outbreak, even the visitation practices of people who are sick in the hospital played a role in transmission. So I think the one good thing is that, now that the outbreak has occurred, the Korean government may be learning based on past lessons, has been much more transparent. They've done widespread testing. They are reporting to the press their findings. They're making recommendations known. This is in contrast to some places. In fact, there's a Washington Post report today that the U.S. CDC recalled test kits. So there are cases occurring in U.S. hospitals that may actually not be diagnosed because there's no kit available. So I think, again, everything in an epidemic is a bit, unknown. Mm. We collect facts. We collect them from the news. Dr. Linton may have additional sources. It's like a detective story. We have to piece things together. And then, can you imagine government officials have to make decisions based on sometimes very limited information. And that's difficult.
Dr. Linton, if I may ask you one more question about the travel ban or what should have been the travel ban. You said that there was overriding opinion upon medical experts in Korea that should have been in place from the beginning. But the administration and the World Health Organization have both said that it wasn't necessary and might not have been effective anyway, especially as you mentioned, the Shincheonji church members, they're Korean citizens, and they would have likely been allowed into the country anyway, even if indeed some members did visit China and Wuhan, as some are speculating.
I want to say that it's pointless to look back at what could have happened. I want to preface it with that. But there were not just Koreans going to China, but there were Chinese, especially Korean Chinese, that were coming to Shincheonji from China. I think it's pointless to argue all of that. We could have done a little better job in tightening the border. Now we have these clusters in Daegu and north of Daegu. I do want to say something very positive about the Chilbyeong Gwalibombu. The CDC of Korea has been very transparent and has tried very hard to be honest, even when they make mistakes. So that, watching them on TV, that's very impressive. Mm. In democratic countries, you have to ask for the cooperation of the public. It's not quite as shall we say, strict as China, where they can just enforce something and, you know, make people do things. It doesn't work that way in pluralistic democracies. And I think the Koreans, many examples of this in their history, in their recent history, are very good at there may be a lot of grumbling and complaining, but when they need to do something, they get together and do it. And I think people are on board. I'm very optimistic. It's not topped out yet. I think there will be more cases. We haven't reached the peak yet, but at some point, of course, I hope and pray also, but I think we're going to gain control. Also, the Centers for Disease Control head in the U.S. said, he made a very interesting comment, that viruses do not recognize borders, and that we're just trying to gain time in blocking this or holding off so that we can see what works as far as treatments. And ultimately, Dr. Kim is much more of an expert than I am on this, but developing a vaccine, which is, you know, the most effective way to control it.
Dr. Kim, would you also agree that we have not reached the peak yet? And then where do you think that peak could be?
Do you mean for the Korean epidemic?
For the Korean epidemic. For the Korean and the global, actually.
Okay. So I think we haven't reached the peak for either. You know, it's still too early in the Korean outbreak to really understand where transmission has occurred and whether the current measures that were put into place to quarantine people who might have been exposed, to test as many people as possible, will be effective in slowing the epidemic or breaking the cycle of epidemic transmission. Globally, it's going to be much more difficult because although the epidemic appears to be decreasing in China, I mean, there are still huge gaps in what we know, you know, what's happening in Africa. I mean, there are almost no cases reported unless you count Egypt. You know, what's happening in the Middle East? I mean, Iran may be the center of an outbreak that may spread through the Middle East. You know, there are countries on the map that have no reported cases, yet have, you know, significant intercourse with China. So again, you know, the lack of cases means that either there aren't any, but could also mean that we're not testing, and there are cases, and so we're not picking them up because we're not testing, but also that we may be testing and afraid to release the information. So again, you know, testing is important, but sharing information is as important.
So, Dr. Kim, would you almost say that Korea has been a victim of its own success in trying to find these cases here in Korea and sharing that information publicly and having that reputation as Korea now being the second hotbed of the virus in the world?
Yeah, I think maybe the thing is not to think about this as being a victim, but the government is being proactive at this point. I mean, once the outbreak occurred, they were very aggressive in, you know, trying to identify where it is, how bad it is, you know, to put resources into place. So in a sense, it may appear that Korea is the victim, but in the end, the Korean people may be protected. And that's the objective, I think, of good government.
Dr. Linton, what needs to happen next now? What about this controversial topic of possibly locking down the southeastern city of Daegu? Daegu and the North Gyeongsang province is, of course, where currently around 80% of the confirmed infections have been found. Should we be considering this drastic step?
Well, the Korean government was very quick to come out, or the Ministry of Health, I should say, and say that the lockdown doesn't mean that we're going to, you know, completely do away with your personal basic human rights. Lockdown means that the government prepares to set up the organization to limit travel, to close down schools, to be even more aggressive. So the word lockdown is not as harsh as what it should have meant. And that's preparing for even stricter measures if they are indeed necessary. So I think the word lockdown was probably caused some misunderstanding, misinterpreted.
But should we be looking at more serious measures to
contain? Absolutely. We should prepare for the worst. And hopefully, you know, we won't need to do that. Absolutely, I agree. my hospital is having an emergency meeting right now as we speak of all the department directors, and I presume it's we haven't used our negative pressure rooms, but I think it has to do with if there's an increase of patients, how we're going to help in the whole process.
Dr. Kim, what do you think about a possible containment of the situation in Daegu, if we use the term lockdown here generally? We've been talking about how we didn't act quick enough in Korea to perhaps block all travel from China. Should we be doing something drastic like that with Daegu and the North Gyeongsang province as well?
So actually, I mean, I completely agree with Dr. Linton. You know, what we're talking about here is for the government to have potential, I mean, or to think about the different scenarios. You know, could it, you know, suddenly explode? Could there be thousands more people infected? To think about that, and then to put into place a series of measures, and best to do it in a planned, prepared way, to have these measures set up. So, you know, they've already put more doctors in place. They've identified hospitals. They've identified wards and sections of hospitals that can be used. I mean, you need to make sure that these things are in place. And then, you know, things like, you know, closing movie theaters and preventing or stopping, or actually in this case, delaying school start, are all things that governments have to do in a graded way to respond to what they perceive to be the problem, and based on information on transmission and other things, you know, make some decisions. It doesn't mean that you're erecting a wall around the city. And, you know, as Dr. Linton again said, in a democratic society, it's difficult to even contemplate that kind of violation of our, you know, basic human rights. But, you know, one of the other things that I've learned about Korea in my 5 years now here is that when the government says, you know, people shouldn't go out, people shouldn't congregate, you know, we shouldn't do these things, then we should wear masks. People do that. It's very different from, you know, the United States, where you might have a lot more difficulty getting that kind of compliance with, you know, government edicts.
Sure, of course, there are still clusters of people who do not comply, as we've covered in the last few days on the Korean news. Dr. Linton, what kind of treatment options do we have at the moment, then, looking forward? And should we be more focusing on treatment now than perhaps prevention and containment? Or does that...
Well, I think
need to be done concurrently.
Is very important. Is, you know, much of our resources should go there, but I think we should look at what the death rates are coming from. It has to do with pulmonary fibrosis. There is, you know, some experimental use of HIV cocktails, but malaria drugs, chloroquine, looks like it's working in preventing, you know, damage, permanent damage to the lung. Fibrosis. So I think we need to explore that more. The studies are coming out of China, actually, what different drugs that are being used, and that is equally important. Even if a death rate is only 3 or 4%, in medicine, that is a very high, you know, statistic. It's hard for us to live with that. You know, some people compare it to a flu, but it is more lethal. It is more statistically, you know, a lot of people, we're used to the flu, so I think we accept the fact that the influenza kills a lot of people every year. But if you compare the two, the death rate is a bit, it's uncomfortable for us as physicians to accept that high mortality.
Dr. Kim, would you agree with that? Could you confirm that COVID-19 perhaps isn't as lethal as SARS and MERS, but it is more dangerous than the flu, like some people have been comparing it with the flu and saying it's not that dangerous?
So it is definitely dangerous. I mean, anything that kills 1% to 2% of the people that it infects is potentially more dangerous than the common everyday flu. You know, the different flu seasons have different rates of mortality depending on the seriousness of the disease. H1N1 maybe killed 500,000 people in 2009, where, you know, the standard flu season might kill 300,000. So there are differences in flu viruses also, but But the COVID-19 virus, you know, appears to be at least 10 times, based on the statistics, different in terms of mortality. But just one word of caution, and I'm you know, purely, I really believe in treating patients who are ill. Remember that 98% of people with this disease, in the absence of, with just supportive treatment, get better. I mean, 2% die, 5% require, you know, intensive care, 14% require hospitalization, but the vast majority of people get better. So if you were to give them, you know, peanut butter or a placebo, 98% of people would get better. So we really need to know for the next time, because I don't think this has gone away, for the next time, what works and what doesn't work. And does it work by, you know, curing people? Does it work by decreasing the number of days of illness? Does it work by keeping people off of ventilators? Does it work by keeping people out of intensive care units? I mean, we really need to do the kinds of studies now, and I think some of them are coming out of China, which is great, in order to know what works and doesn't work. Because in situations like this, I mean, doctors get, you know, want people to get better also. So, you know, we really believe that we were put here to help people.
How far away are we from actually knowing things like the things that you've mentioned, and how far are we from things such as a vaccine for COVID-19?
So I think, as Dr. Lin mentioned, we were told the data are coming out of China shortly with the results from clinical trials, which I presume are randomized. That is, some people may get a placebo and other people may get active treatment, but I don't know because I don't know any of those trials. For vaccines, the typical figure, if you were to go to a vaccine company today and say, so how long will it take to make a vaccine against, you know, a standard pneumonia germ, they'll say, well, 5 to 10 years and $500 million to $1 billion of investment, which isn't really in the time frame for an epidemic outbreak. So when we think about this, a bunch of people after the Ebola outbreak said, look, we need to get together. We need to find a better way to do this so we actually develop vaccines in time and are able to test them to make sure that they work to prevent these very serious illnesses. So a number of countries, the Gates Foundation, the Wellcome Trust, banded together and put in nearly $1 billion into a fund called CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. And immediately after hearing about the outbreak, CEPI put out a call for proposals, contacted several companies that have what we call platforms. That is, things that are very easily modified quickly to develop new vaccines. So typically, there are things like, we call them RNA and DNA vaccines, but you can make them very quickly. In fact, one of the companies said within 3 hours of seeing the published sequence, they had designed the vaccine. And that vaccine could be in human testing, you know, as early as April or May of this year. Another company actually will begin clinical testing maybe in the next month or two. So, again, because of CEPI, because they were able to put enough funding quickly into place, we may have vaccines that can be tested. But CEPI is a cooperative venture, and they prepared for this. They were waiting for what they call disease X, which this may very well be. And they were, you know, they put the funding there for vaccines to be developed quickly. And that is really the important thing. I think both of us have been saying, you know, we have to work together. I mean, you know, we say protect yourself, protect others individually. You know, protect yourself, protect your family, protect others.
Sure.
But as countries, we should do the same thing. You protect the country, but by cooperating and by doing the right thing, we can protect other countries. And CEPI is just another example of how cooperation foster more rapid development.
It sounds like a very interesting and promising idea. Maybe it could be something that could work in Asia, but I think that's something we'll have to touch upon next time. One final question, very briefly, Dr. Linton. There's been some suggestion that the outbreak might start to die down once spring comes and the weather starts to get better and hotter. Is there any evidence towards this at the moment?
I will defer to Dr. Kim. I think he knows on the more viral level how sensitive this organism is to heat.
Dr. Kim?
So it's been said that this may be a cold weather virus, but I think the one thing to bear in mind is that we don't know. And the second is, again, just based on our experience with flu, you know, the wintertime flu season in the northern hemisphere is a summertime season in the southern hemisphere, where the winter and summer are reversed. In the tropics, it's present all year round. So we don't know if it's going to behave in a flu-like way. And I think that's the thing, again, you know, all of this epidemic outbreak response is preparedness. So we have to be now ready to look at Southern Hemisphere transmission, transmission in the tropics. We know, for instance, there was lots of transmission in Singapore, which is hot.
We'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. We've been speaking to Dr. In Yohan, Dr. John Linton, Director of the International Healthcare Center at Yonsei University Severance Hospital, and Dr. Jerome Kim, Director General of the International Vaccine Institute. Thank you both for your time today, and we hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 26.84 points, or 1.28% on Wednesday. It ended the day at 2,076.77. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 2.32 points, or 0.35%, to close at 654.63. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 6.6 won against the dollar, ending the session at 1,216.9 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Right, we continue on now to our daily segment, Korea Trending. This is where we discuss some of the other news stories that have been trending online here in Korea Today. And bringing us those stories today is Pei Ju-yeon, who joins us on the line. Hello, Ju-yeon.
Hello, Chang-woo. For trending topics, we'll talk about the Korea Post's plan to sell face masks via a shopping website. We also will find out about a donation made by actor Kim Woo-bin in efforts to block the spread of COVID-19. And finally, we'll learn about Korean tennis player Kwon Soon-woo advancing into the round of 16 of the Mexican Open.
Okay, so we start on an update on the situation concerning masks here in Korea. Can you tell us more?
Sure. The Korea Post's shopping website was trending widely after the Korea Post announced on Tuesday that it will soon offer the sale of face masks through its site. The move comes after the Ministry of Food and Drug Safety tentatively implemented measures on the urgent supply and demand of face masks and hand sanitizers in the wake of a sharp rise in COVID-19 cases in the nation.
Right. Just yesterday, we reported on our show that the government had decided to limit the exports of masks to other countries and make them accessible to the Korean public more as quickly as possible through official distributors. And that includes the Korea Post and public home shopping, right?
That's right. The Korea Post is set to secure anywhere between 1.2 and 1.5 million face masks a day. In order to enable more people to buy masks, the Post Service will limit the number of masks that customers can purchase to one set per person.
Do we know when this service will be available yet?
That information, along with the price of the masks, has yet to be disclosed. However, an official of the Post Service did say that the website will likely begin to sell them starting from early March. It should be noted that if you want to buy the masks through the Korea Post shopping website, you must first sign up for a membership.
Yes, and hopefully the Post Office website is ready for the huge wave of traffic it will get once it does go online. It would be frustrating if people could not buy masks that are available because the website had crashed due to so many people logging on. But hopefully there will be enough supply soon everywhere that it won't become a problem. What's next on our trending list today?
Actor Kim Woo-bin was heating up the internet after he donated 100 million won to help combat the spread of COVID-19. On Wednesday, the Community Chest of Korea said that Kim had made the donation and asked the social welfare body to use it to help the socially vulnerable in their response to the spread of the virus.
Right, that is the equivalent of about $100,000. That's very generous of him. Do we know how the donation is expected to be used?
Yes, to purchase face masks and hand sanitizers for the most vulnerable in society so they can both prevent infection and protect their immune system.
Sure, especially when masks are so hard to come by at the moment, as we discussed earlier. Now, this isn't the first time Kim has made donations to help those in need, is it?
That's right. Back in 2014, Kim became part of the Community Chest of Korea's Honor Society after he donated 110 million won to help teenagers and low-income families. Individuals who donate at least 100 million won are added to the organization's Honor Society. Kim, who put his career on hold after being diagnosed with nasopharyngeal cancer in May 2017, is set to return to the screen sometime soon.
Right, that cancer is why we haven't seen him in the spotlight in recent years, but he is said to have fully completed his treatment plan, which is good to hear. Now, he's not the only celebrity to have made a generous donations to fight the coronavirus outbreak, is he?
Yeah, trot singer Song Ga-in said she will donate all proceeds earned through digital music sales of a remake of a hit song by the late singer Lee Hwa-ja in efforts to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in the nation. In addition, singers Hun Mi, actresses Shin Min-ah and Lee Young-hae, TV personality Yoo Jae-seok, and actor Lee Byung-hun also made donations.
So Korean celebrities doing what they can to help the nation in this difficult time. That's great to hear as well. Let's move on now to our final trending topic for today. What do you have for us?
South Korean tennis player Kwon Soon-woo was causing a buzz online after he advanced into the round of 16 of the Mexican Open, which is part of the Association of Tennis Professionals Tour 500 series. Kwon achieved a feat after he defeated Taro Daniel of Japan 2-1 during the first round of the Mexican Open at Acapulco on Tuesday. Daniel has won 5 ATP Challenger Tour singles titles. He saw his world ranking climb to 64th in 2018, mainly thanks to his first title win at the Istanbul Open in May of that same year.
I understand that Kwon was initially set to play a different player other than Taro Daniel.
That's right. Kwon was set to face American player Riley Opelka in the first round, but was instead matched against Daniel after Opelka's decision to pull out of the competition. Opelka, who won the Del Rey Beach Open last week, was regarded to be a formidable opponent, as Kwon had fallen 0-2 to the American player in the third round of the same tournament.
Now, the last time we talked about Kwon, he had just beaten Milos Raonic in an upset at the New York Open, and that was to reach the quarterfinals, but unfortunately he wasn't able to get past that next round. However, he's been showing a promising level of consistency, reaching 3 quarterfinals in the last 3 ATP Tour events he's taken part in. Isn't that correct?
That's right, and he's hoping to reach the quarterfinals of the Mexican Open as well. Kwon is aiming for better results than last year when he played in 2 ATP 500 tournaments but failed to make it to the qualifying round in both.
Okay, so who's he set to play against next then?
He will face Dusan Lajovic of Serbia.
Yes, and that match will take place at 7 a.m. Korea time Thursday. Let's hope he can make 4 out of 4 quarterfinals in a row and possibly even go at least one better. That's all for today's Career Trending. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Jiyeon, and we'll speak to you again next time.
Thank you, Jung-ho.
Now time once again for our weekly feature, Korea Book Club. Here we introduce you to some notable Korean literary works that are available in the English language, as well as learn about Korean literature in general. Helping us do that is our wonderful literary critic, Barry Welsh, who joins us now in the studio. Hello, Barry. It's good to see you again.
Yes, good evening. Good to be back.
So what book are you introducing us to this week?
So today's book is The Only Child, written by So Mi-ae and translated by Chong Ye-won. And it was published in Korean under the original Korean title of Chal Chayo Oma in 2018. And it's only just been published in English this past couple of weeks, past week or so, in fact. And it's one of the first big new releases in Korean fiction in translation this year. So it's very highly anticipated in certain circles, and it's been quite widely publicized, and there's a lot of hype behind it, and it's riding quite a big wave of anticipation amongst a certain group of readers, and I guess amongst the sort of Korean literary community in general.
That's very exciting.
You're right, yeah, so it is exciting for us. And Saw is a best-selling novelist and drama writer and movie writer here in Korea, has quite a long and well-established career. This is her first book to be translated into English and published in English, but it comes after the success of several other Korean crime thrillers, many of which we've talked about on the show. So Pyeon Hae-young's The Hole and Chong Yoo-jung's The Good Son and The Plotters and several other books like that that have been very successful. And so there's a lot of expectation behind this book. But So has been around and very successful in Korea since her debut in 1994. She debuted with an award-winning short story called 30 Ways to Kill Your Husband. And her novels include The Doll's Garden, The Night Your Star Disappeared, and a short story collection called The Murderer I'd Like to Meet. And she's also written several screenplays, written for several dramas, some of which have been adapted from her own novels and stories. Mm. And
So going from the titles, it seems like a lot of crime thrillers, and yeah, I do love that title, 30 Ways to Kill Your Husband.
Right, yeah.
It reminds me of that acclaimed novel Gone Girl, that kind of vibe
title. Right. Mm-hmm. Right, so actually, I was going to mention Gillian Flynn a little bit later, so there are some similarities between Gillian Flynn's books and this book. But yeah, so in recent years, there has been the success of several other Korean crime and genre novels, and there's this building sense that Korean thrillers, and in some places you'll hear them referred to as K-thrillers, and genre novels are poised to be the next big thing internationally. So we had the Nordic Noir series, you know, with books like Stieg Larsson's series of books and Joe Nesbo's series of books. There's an ongoing trend for Scottish crime novels. And there's this expectation among some publishers and sort of book pundits that maybe Korea will be next, and that maybe this is the novel that will be the tipping point where Korean genre fiction enters, global mainstream awareness and popularity.
Hmm, interesting. I mean, crime thrillers are already a very popular genre in Korean films as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm, so there's definitely potential there that I can see. So can you tell us more about this book then and the story? What is it about?
Right, so this isn't a book that hides its influences. It's definitely wearing its influences on its sleeve. And the main influence is Silence of the Lambs, right? So the classical psychological crime thriller by Thomas Harris about FBI rookie Clarice Starling and infamous serial killer Hannibal Lecter. And in The Only Child, we meet Lee Sun-kyung, who's a young woman living in Seoul and teaching criminal psychology at a university. And she briefly studied with the FBI in America, and when her students learn this, they nickname her Clarice. So it's signaling her influences very clearly.
Yeah, you're not kidding about that.
Right, and we're also introduced to an infamous serial killer called Lee Byung-do, and he's currently in prison, having recently been arrested, murdered 13 women, possibly many more. He has a deceptively attractive appearance, and for some reason, following his arrest, Lee Byung-do insists he will only speak to Sun-kyung, even though they've never met, and she's very young, and she's at the beginning of her career. So thus, we have a very familiar setup of a young woman at the beginning of her career interviewing a notorious and extremely clever and violent serial killer.
If I might say so, the story does sound like it's possibly too inspired by Silence of the Lambs. There are a lot of similarities there. And both the book and the film, of course, are a lot to live up to. Does Tsar manage to live up to that comparison that she set herself up for?
Right, so it is arguably quite derivative, but there's not necessarily anything wrong with that. So novels, you know, they recycle plots and concepts all the time. And so how well you do it, like how well do you employ these, you know, well-known tropes? How strong is your mastery of genre elements is a big question, right? But there's also another important strand in the novel. And so through a series of very strange circumstances, Sun-kyung's doctor husband brings his 11-year-old daughter from a previous marriage to live in their house. This is other big element in the novel. Mm-hmm. And so as Sun-kyung observes this 11-year-old girl, her name's Ha-young, and she's observing her behavior, she increasingly thinks that this young girl may be a budding psychopath. And so through this juxtaposition of young Ha-young and the incarcerated Byung-do, So is probing the question of nature or nurture, right? So are some people born truly evil, destined to be monsters, or is it nurture, the way we're raised, that decides who we are? So it's such an old concept, you know, dozens of movies and books have explored this, this very, common idea, but So has a lot of fun with it, nevertheless.
Okay, so that does sound like there are some different elements that it is playing with as well, and it could be fun to see how she plays with that. understand there's also an unusual musical influence in this story. Can you tell us about that?
Right, yeah. So the Beatles song, Maxwell's Silver Hammer, which I'm sure lots of people are familiar with. So it's from Abbey Road, and it's one of Paul McCartney's songs, and it plays a key role in the novel. So it's a song that the serial killer, Lee Byung-do, he's obsessed with for various important reasons. And this song recurs throughout the story in various significant places. The chorus of the song is Bang, bang, Maxwell's silver hammer came down upon her head. Bang, bang, Maxwell's silver hammer made sure that she was dead. And so this becomes significant for a couple of different reasons throughout the story. But it's just an interesting little little influence that's woven through the story.
I have to say, I hadn't heard of this song before we were preparing for this segment. I actually had to listen to it just before we came on, and it is very bizarre.
Right.
Per the lyrics you just read, it's about a murderous student called Maxwell.
Yeah, right, right. Mm-hmm.
But it's sung in this jovial, upbeat, kind of folksy kind of manner. Highly inappropriate and strange.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So apparently the story behind this song is that the other Beatles hated it. They didn't like this song at all, but Paul McCartney insisted on recording it. I don't think John Lennon's actually even on this song. I think it's the other three. So yeah, it is a strange song, but I think that sort of juxtaposition, you know, the difference between the jovial tone that you mentioned and then these very disturbing lyrics, that is, you know, that's important for Lee Byung-do because he's this, you know, deceptive, you know, handsome man. He looks like a very innocent and appealing figure, but really he's this damaged and very disturbed person.
Yeah, I read in one article that it's regarded as one of the worst songs the Beatles ever recorded.
Right.
And if there's ever evidence of why the Beatles broke up, this song is one of them.
Oh, right.
That's what it said. So interesting song to center this narrative around.
Right.
Barry, you said earlier that this work was highly anticipated. Mm-hmm. Does it justify the hype?
Well, I have mixed feelings following having read this book recently.
Okay.
So I was, you know, very much looking forward to it. And there are some, you know, very strong elements. You know, it has a very gripping beginning. The final 20 pages or so are very, very gripping, and there's lots of twists. But it's also not subtle. So it's exploring this theme of nature nurture, but it's really quite obvious in some places. There's some pacing problems as well, and some of the sections are a little sloppy, and then the conclusion might be a little bit rushed. And certainly I think if you're an avid crime fan, if you read a lot of crime novels, there's not that much new here. She's mashing these two different concepts together, you know, the serial killer story and then the potentially evil child story. And that's quite an interesting idea, but I think maybe none of the characters really, you know, leap out of the book. That Lee Byung-do is kind of a generic character, and Song Jong herself is almost characterless. She's a bit of a doormat character, which is, it's just a strangely devoid of personality at times. And you mentioned Gillian Flynn earlier, right? So Gillian Flynn's obviously had this huge success with these, you know, serial killer stories, like not Gone Girl, but her other books,
right.
Sharp Objects and Dark Places. But Flynn is a much more stylish writer, and there's something that maybe that this book is just not quite as stylish as some of the other crime novels. I certainly don't think it's as good as the other, you know, big Korean books. Like, it's not as original or as unique as The Plotters. It doesn't have the sophistication of things like Mina by Kim Sagwa. And so it was a little bit disappointing overall, but there's still some gripping elements, right? So there are good elements to it, but perhaps it's a little less than the sum of its parts.
And do you think, finally, crime thrillers can make it as a Korean K-thriller, as you said, in the international kind of arena?
Right, yeah. Well, lots of people are talking about it. So, you know, The Plotters, which we talked about within the last month or so, was, you know, very successful and, a very unique and stylish and clever and had lots of, you know, interesting ideas. And, I absolutely think there is. There's lots of big releases coming out in the next several months, and I'm sure some of those will be big hits and crossover, and people will be excited about them.
Well, we look forward to you reading them and then to telling us about it here on Korea Book Club. We've been talking about The Only Child this week, written by Song Mi-ae. Mm. Thank you for introducing us to this work, Barry, and we'll see you again next time.
Okay, take care.
And we wrap things up there for another edition of Korea 24. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the latest updates and analysis on the COVID-19 outbreak, as well as our regular features. Until then, I've been your host, Kwon Jang-woo, and thank you for listening. Goodbye.